from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, and this week for Michael Krasny. Julia Morgan's life was a life of firsts. In 1894, she was the only female engineering graduate at UC Berkeley. A few years later, she became the first woman to ever earn an architecture degree from the prestigious L'École des Beaux-Arts in Paris. And in 1904, she became the first woman to secure an architecture license in California. And she was just getting started. Over a 50-year career, she would go on to design over 700 buildings, most famously Hearst Castle in San Simeon. Among her other noteworthy accomplishments, 100 buildings for women's organizations alone. The life and times of the remarkable Julia Morgan. Next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, in this week for Michael Krasny. In 1919, William Randolph Hearst inherited the ranch land near San Simeon, where he wanted to build, and he knew just the architect for the job. Julia Morgan, who'd built the Examiner building for him in Los Angeles a few years before. "We're tired of camping out in the open," Hearst wrote Morgan, "and I'd like to build a little something." That little something would become a 28-year project for Julia Morgan, a 165-room compound featuring gardens, pools, a zoo, and 59 bathrooms. Hearst Castle, as it came to be known, was Julia Morgan's best-known project. But her contributions to American architecture and American life go far deeper. Born in the 1870s, she was the first woman licensed to practice architecture in California. And in the first half of the 20th century, she played a unique role as a woman who built and as a builder for women, designing over 100 buildings for women's organizations and colleges. She was also incredibly prolific, designing over 700 buildings over a 50-year career. Frank Lloyd Wright, by comparison, clocked in a mere 532 structures. And 2 years ago, nearly 60 years after her death, she became the first woman to receive the highest award bestowed by the American Institute of Architects, the Gold Medal Award. And so in this hour of Forum, we take up the remarkable life of Julia Morgan. Joining us to take up that conversation first, Karen McNeil, local scholar and author and historian. She wrote her PhD thesis about the life of Julia Morgan and also collaborated in the making of the AIA award of the gold medal for Julia Morgan. Karen McNeil, welcome. Happy to have you on our program.
Thank you. Good morning.
And joining us as well is Julia Donahoe. She is an architect and attorney. She led that effort to get the AIA award for Julia Morgan, the first woman to receive that award from the American Institute of Architects. Julia Donahoe, good morning as well.
Thank you, Dave. Good morning to you.
Let's go back to the beginning of this remarkable woman and remarkable life. Born in 1872, went to the University of California, Berkeley, went to school there and graduated with this degree in engineering. She wasn't the first woman, Karen McNeil, to graduate with a degree in engineering in 1894, though she was the only woman to graduate this year. But take us back to that time and sort of set the scene for us, how unusual that was and what early signs perhaps there were in that time. If you could portray what her life was like, maybe some indicators of maybe the push that she was making, perhaps even then for the life that she was making for women at Cal in the 1890s, the indicators perhaps that foretold the kind of life she might live.
So Julia Morgan was born into a fairly affluent family in Oakland, or born in San Francisco, grew up in Oakland. And they traveled frequently back to her parents' hometown in Brooklyn, where she would visit with her mother's cousin's husband, Pierre Lebrun, frequently. And he was part of Napoleon Lebrun and Sons, a prominent architecture firm in New York City, responsible for designing all the firehouses in New York City during Julia Morgan's childhood. And so she would talk to him. She would learn from him and visit all of those places. And ultimately, he designed the Metropolitan Life Tower overlooking Madison Square. And so that's one source of inspiration. And she had aptitude in every way. She was always remembered as a student who was good in Latin. She was good at playing the violin. She thought about medicine. But the problem solving, perhaps, that came with designing buildings was interesting to her, infinitely intriguing. And then she got to Cal. She started out in mechanical engineering and switched to civil engineering. There was no architecture program at the time. She attended all these courses where she was sometimes the only woman in these math and science courses and thrived, you know. And she thrived often because she had, early on, this group of women. Kappa Alpha Theta sorority was founded at the time. And they were this group of women who provided her the support system to flourish in whatever way she wanted. They were just incredibly supportive of her, even though they weren't following in her footsteps.
And was she someone who early on sort of pushed for equal access for women? I read, perhaps it was in one of your articles, that she pushed for women's access to the gymnasium. Was she always someone who pushed?
You know what? She was on the sidelines. She was quietly doing rather than vocally pushing. So when she was an undergraduate, she was very much associated with all the women who were more overtly pushing to get access to the gymnasium and to have sporting clubs and other access to different amenities that the men would have. So she was a part of it, but always kind of quiet.
And then from her time at Cal, she went on, because there wasn't an architecture program, she was encouraged to go on to L'École des Beaux-Arts in Paris to study architecture. And Julia Donahoe, that was unusual because there was never, no woman had ever gone there before. And it was not easy for her to get in. In fact, she was denied initially early admission.
Actually, you will see in the letters from her to Pierre Lebrun that when she got to Paris, she found two American women who were studying architecture at the École des Beaux-Arts, Faye Kellogg and Catherine
Bud.
And she writes on the edge of the letter, "This is our apartment. Bud's here. I'm here. And the men are down here." And she moved into the atelier as Faye Kellogg was leaving town and took her seat. And she could barely talk to the head of the atelier. So she found there were American women studying. They had both applied to sit for examinations and were denied. They were refused. So they learned what they could. They were allowed to sit in classes and observe if there was an empty seat. But they learned a lot while they were in Paris, and then they went back and became architects. They went on and worked as architects, and in 1918, they all worked together on some YWCA hostess houses during the war effort. So she kept in touch with them for over 20 years and did work with them later, and they were all architects.
But she became, as I understand it, the first person to actually be awarded a degree at L'École des Beaux-Arts. And initially, there was great resistance to actually her being admitted and officially designated an official student there. Yeah. Is that correct, Karen?
Absolutely. I mean, her experience at the École des Beaux-Arts was really put a fire under her as her place as a woman in architecture. So Julia Morgan arrived in June of 1896, and with knowing that maybe some courses would be open to women, maybe. And almost the day she arrived there, the faculty had decided that, okay, women can take courses, but they cannot enroll in degree programs. They had a promise that they would be able to enroll a year later. So a year later, they said, okay, so women can take the enrollment examinations into terminal degree programs. They gave the women 5 weeks to prepare, which was incredibly difficult to begin with. But for architecture, you had to do mathematics, you had to do sculpting, you had to do designing, all this stuff. And the mathematics were in French in front of an audience, and Julia Morgan was scrambling. And at that point, she did say to the faculty, she said, "Come on, I'm one woman. You know, I'm not going to overturn the apple cart or anything like that. You're not going to set a precedent. Just, you know, let me in." And they said something to the effect, "Miss Morgan has every right to take the examinations, but we will not give her any special treatment." And she had, again, another group of really important women they had been organized for years to fight for women to gain access to the École. And they were pushing Morgan along, and Bernard Maybeck was pushing Morgan along. And she took the first examination and just outright failed. But everybody did the first time. The second time she took the examination, she stopped because she realized she wasn't going to pass. The third time, she thought she had done better on every part of the examination, and she got her scores back and had done worse on every part of the examination, and she was profoundly demoralized and embarrassed, and she ran into her maître, and he said, well, you know, you're never going to get in because you're a woman. And she heard that from Bernard Maybeck. She said, you know, you're a woman, you might not get in. And she heard this from multiple people. And so at that time, she said, well, you know, I'm going to take this examination 11 times or until I turn 30, whichever comes first. And 30 was the cutoff date, because they're not going to discourage a woman from getting into the École des Beaux-Arts because she's a woman. So she fought and she fought, and eventually she came in 13th out of nearly 400 candidates, her fourth time in October 1898.
And finally succeeded, finally finished there, came back to the United States. You mentioned Maybeck, her early mentor at the University of California, did work at the UC Berkeley, did some early design work on the famous Greek theater at UC Berkeley. Moved on, though, began her own architecture practice and began this then remarkable career over the first half of the 20th century. Many of those buildings, of course, you can still see today in the East Bay in particular. And I want to begin talking about some of these buildings, and we'll encourage over the course of our hour for people to call in. And you can call in or email us at kqed.org, call in at 866-733-6786 and tell us some of your favorite buildings. But I want to ask first about one in particular that in many ways is, I think, key to understanding both her background and what triggered her career, which was an early commission she got at Mills College, which was to build a bell tower. And it's significant because it speaks to her engineering background, significant because the time in which she built it in the early 1900s, significant because it withstood the earthquake.
And is still standing today.
Right.
With no seismic retrofit.
So tell us that story. What happened? Why was it? What did it speak to in terms of her expertise? How did it become significant in developing her career?
Oh, the campanile is one of the most important structures in Julia Morgan's career. So Mills College had been around since 1852, and it was a highly respected institution by the turn of the 20th century. But Berkeley and Stanford had grown significantly in the past 10 years and were threatening the very existence of Mills College because they provided free education to women in higher education. So Mills College needed to, again, stake a claim in this landscape. And they had these bells that had been at the Chicago World's Fair. And then Francis Marion Smith, who was a significant developer in the East Bay, said, I'll build a bell tower for it. And Mills said, okay, but this has to be super duper special. We need Julia Morgan to design it. She wasn't necessarily the only woman architect, but she was the most highly educated woman architect in the country. And they needed to modernize, say that they were modernizing by hiring this woman in this new profession. And they worked with her to pick the right style, and they chose the mission style because it's the oldest permanent architecture in the state of California, harkening back Mills College's history. And so design-wise, construction-wise, the technology-wise, she chose reinforced concrete construction. She chose that. And she didn't cover up the aggregate with paint or plaster or anything. She had problems with the builder who tried to throw her under the bus in terms of her expertise. So she realized, you know, that it was going to be really difficult for her no matter how much support she had around the public. So he ultimately he got his name above hers in all the ceremonial materials. But it was really important because two reasons. One, the reinforced concrete construction, this was the first time that it had been used aesthetically instead of for infrastructure or factories and industrial buildings. And that was revolutionary at the time. And then when the earthquake and fires hit, the bell tower endured without a crack. And so Mills College became a laboratory for other architects and engineers to see how this important technology could be used.
Actually, there's one other thing about it that's really fascinating. So a bell tower that was freestanding from a church was unusual. And when she was in Paris, she went around and did a lot of drawings of a bell tower that looked very similar to what she ended up doing. And she used buttresses here. So we can see that she's moving to mission, but she's also using these techniques to ensure that this tall, thin building won't fall over. So it's not it's just the form as well as the reinforcing. And this was unique because at the same time in 1903, Auguste Perret, who was her classmate at the Beaux-Arts, was building a building in Paris called 25 Bis Rue Franklin. It's in all the books. And he used a patented reinforcing system that allowed him to free up the facade and the plan. Well, she took reinforced concrete and she poured it in a mold and stripped it. So she used it in this purely plastic form to create a sculpture. Yeah. This building is an incredible sculpture, and she did it in 6-inch lifts. She was very specific with the specifications for the concrete and how it was placed, and 72 feet tall. So it's really an exquisite building in that respect. And that it's.
And how did that structure, which survived the 1906 quake, then serve as an impetus for her career? Not that long after that, the Fairmont Hotel in San Francisco was destroyed. She then was sought after because that building.
Exactly. The building codes
the
actually.
Bell Tower survived?
The building codes in 1904 said you can use concrete in a foundation, but that's really the only place they've mentioned it. You can look at 1907 building code, and you can see by 4 months after the earthquake, they had revised the whole building code. So reinforced concrete in the foundations, reinforced concrete in the walls, reinforced concrete in the columns, reinforced concrete in the slabs, and all the ads in architect and engineer turn to reinforced concrete withstands fire, withstands earthquake. It's the best building material in seismic country. And it was because of that building standing up, and it was because of the buildings at Stanford also standing up by the same contractor. But she used a patented reinforcing system from that contractor, but the design and the structural ideas and the sculptural form, it was the first 5-story tower west of the Mississippi, and it's really not in the history books in the way it should be.
Yeah, at the time, I mean, it made national news. I mean, The campanile appears in almost more professional journals across many different disciplines within architecture and building.
And so she really started to make her mark. She got the job to redo the Fairmont Hotel, which had been destroyed in the 1906 quake. Someone came out to interview her, couldn't believe that she was actually the architect, thought she had just done the decorative work inside the Fairmont, couldn't believe that she was really the architect, and began to get commissions, and her career really took off. I want to welcome into our conversation now Ty O. Smith, who is chief of museum interpretation at the Hearst Castle in San Simeon, of course, the most famous of all of Julia Morgan's projects. Ty Smith, thanks very much for being part of our conversation today as well.
Oh, it's an honor. Thank you for having me.
Mr. Smith, the Hearst Castle, of course, is such a famous contribution and went on for such a long period in Julia Morgan's career. And we're jumping far ahead now in the Julia Morgan story. But the Hearst connection really does go back to the beginning of Morgan's career, because she knew William Randolph Hearst's mother, Phoebe, from the beginning of her association her time at the University of California, and worked on Phoebe Hearst's home near the University of California. Describe a little bit of that relationship, if you would, and how that was an important part of Morgan's early career.
Well, certainly it could be said that Julia Morgan was sort of the family architect for the Hearst, and her associations do go back to the Berkeley campus. Phoebe Apperson Hearst was the first woman regent of UC Berkeley, and she certainly had a hand in encouraging women to take on roles that were not traditional to women through her support of the sorority and her encouragement specifically of Morgan to attend the Ecole and offering to pay for a part of her education there. So when she came back to California and started practicing architecture, she had built-in clientele in terms of Phoebe and what she wanted. So William Randolph Hearst was acquainted with her early on through those early projects.
We'll come back to the story of St. Simeon and Hearst Castle, which is such a famous part of not only Julia Morgan's story, but the story of California in so many ways as well. But what Ty Smith just touched on is such a central part of Julia Morgan's story, and why I know it was so central to your desire to make sure that Morgan got the recognition, the gold medal award posthumously. And that's this key role that she really played in promoting women's organizations. Phoebe Hearst played a role in that. It was remarkable to me in reading about her that she built over 100 buildings for women's organizations, for YWCAs. Cecile Amar, of course, famously had its roots in the YWCA movement. Give us a little bit of insight into that, if you would, Karen McNeil, about why that was so important to her and the lasting significance that that has.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, she really got the fire under her to make her career about women and creating opportunities for women in Paris. She understood, you know, the kind of discrimination that she faced. And then, you know, there's a little bit of the class you're born into, the people you know to start your career. So from the outset, she was working for women. Before Mills even, there were other organizations, women's organizations in Oakland that she was designing for. And then Phoebe Hearst introduced her to the YWCA in 1911. And ultimately, you know, Julia Morgan, she would put herself out there. She would lose money on all sorts of projects for women's organizations to make sure that they were built. And she would work with the organizations. She would ask them what the people who were going to use the buildings wanted. And she created modern spaces for young women to flourish in all different sorts of ways.
And was that central to why it was so important to you, Julia Donahoe, to get this recognition for her as the first woman architect to get this gold medal award?
My initial impetus was because of Beverly Willis of the Beverly Willis Architectural Foundation was giving some talks about how come the AIA can't give a gold medal to a woman. And so when I became a board member of the National AIA, I was like, well, I read the rules. I saw three men were shortlisted. Tom Main won that year, so California was very, very happy. But three white men were shortlisted, and I looked at the list. He was number 69 in a long list of people. And so I said, we need to change that number 0. 0 is unacceptable. Beverly Willis was saying 0 is unacceptable. I think we need to do that. And then I read the rules. As a board member, I could nominate someone, and I was like, wow. I have the opportunity, and I seized it. And I looked around who is the appropriate person to start with, and it was Julia Morgan.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we want to hear from you. What are your favorite Julia Morgan buildings in California? What makes them special to you? What is it about her that is so distinguishing? We'd love to hear from you. You can join us at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can email us at forum@kqed.org, or you can send us a tweet. Our handle is @KQED Forum, or you can post your thoughts at our website, kqed.org/forum. Tell us a story about your favorite experience at a Julia Morgan building. We'll be back with more in just a moment. This is Forum at KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson in this week for Michael Krasny. Our topic this hour, the trailblazing career of architect Julia Morgan. 2 years ago, she became the first woman to receive the Gold Medal Award, the highest award bestowed by the American Institute of Architects. Her career throughout the first half of the 20th century included the design of over 700 buildings throughout California, included, of course, the famous Hearst Castle in San Simeon. Our guests include Ty Smith, who is the chief of museum interpretation at Hearst Castle, Julia Donahoe, architect and attorney who led led the nomination battle for, not battle, I guess, but the nomination effort to, what was it, a battle? It was a battle. All right, we'll get to the battle then of Julia Morgan to receive that award for the American Institute Gold Medal Award. And Karen McNeil, local author and scholar of Julia Morgan. You can join our conversation at 866-733-6786. You can email us at forum@kqed.org or post your thoughts at our website, kqed.org/forum. Love to hear your thoughts on favorite buildings and favorite experiences at Julia Morgan buildings throughout the state of California. Ty Smith, tell us something more about the experience that Julia Morgan is best known for, the construction of Hearst Castle. It was a three-decade experience, beginning in 1919 when William Randolph Hearst first wrote Julia Morgan saying he wanted to build a little something in the ranch lands near San Simeon. It went on for those many, many years. It was this ongoing, perpetual work in progress. Say something about their relationship. It sounds like, from what I've read, it was always quite formal. They had this lengthy Mr. and Miss correspondence, and that it was always evolving, always ongoing, always being added on to. What was that like for Julia Morgan to have William Randolph Hearst as a client?
Well, it was a long and fruitful relationship. I mean, the place wasn't commissioned and built. It was designed and redesigned and built and rebuilt over almost three decades. And Julia Morgan said at one time that Mr. Hearst suffered from a condition called changeableness of mind, which is maybe the furthest she went in complaining about many of the changes that went on. Julia Morgan had range, and so we look at the brown shingle bungalows in the Berkeley Hills, and we look at Beaux-Arts-style YWCA buildings, and then you have something like Hearst Castle, which really defies all description in the abstract. And what we see, I think, what was in it for her in a way, even though she built three outdoor pools and added on and was sort of constantly reacting to Hearst's changeableness of mind, is it gave her a real laboratory to play on a scale and with materials that she didn't get a chance with her other projects. So really bringing to flower kind of all of her influences, all of her styles, but then also what she learned at the Ecole and putting that into place with those materials. So it was mutually beneficial, if at times frustrating.
You know, one thing you're saying, Ty Smith, that I think is interesting is that there are many people who visit San Simeon who think of it as kind of this kind of mishmash, hodgepodge warehouse almost of stuff for all of William Randolph Hearst's famous collections of things. In a sense, though, it sounds like what you're saying is it shows her adaptability. You know, that while she was famous for certain kinds of arts and crafts style, that she was client friendly, and that she was willing to adapt and adjust and kind of make that she was adaptable and flexible.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, she was a client's architect, and you think of other architects who weren't so client friendly. Frank Lloyd Wright comes to mind, where he would build something in a certain way, furnish it in a certain way, and expect that the client retain that in perpetuity. But Julia Morgan, whether she was working with a family in Berkeley, one of the first things that she would do is go sit down with the clients, sometimes the clients' children, and really get a sense of what they wanted and needed out of the space. And so her relationship with William Randolph Hearst was no different. She was really trying to give the client what the client wanted and needed. And at Hearst Castle, it's a very different, sort of place where Hearst was trying to entertain the who's who of the world and provide really this fantasy outdoor lifestyle for his guests to enjoy. But at the same time, he was also trying to create a backdrop for his decorative arts collection. And Julia Morgan was happy to meet the challenges that faced, that faced her in terms of what his needs were and how his needs evolved.
It's an interesting way of sort of putting it into perspective, I think, Karen McNeil, that she was an egalitarian sort of architect, whether she was building a home for someone in Berkeley or building something massive like Hearst Castle.
Oh, absolutely. She was always working with the clients to create the buildings and spaces that they needed. Function came first. That was a primary principle of the Ecole. And so you had to work with the clients to figure out how the place was going to function. I have a fun anecdote to illustrate that, yes, she worked with her clients, but she wasn't a pushover. She did push back, including with Hearst. And so he was a big America First person in the 1930s. And they were discussing the design plans for the Roman pool, the indoor pool, with all the lapis lazuli and gold leaf tiles. And he wanted to go with an Italian tile maker, and he wanted Murano glass. He was going to Italy. And she pushed back. She said, "Well, you know, Mr. Hearst, you're always talking about America First, so shouldn't we do something local?" And so she went with this Italian family in North Beach, and they laid together all of the tiles for this enormous pool in Fugazi Hall, which people now will know as the location of Beach Blanket Babylon.
Great story. By the way, we've asked people to write in some of their comments about favorite things about Hearst, Julia Morgan buildings. And Kim writes in, speaking of pools, "I'm actually a fan of her pools most. They really make me appreciate her talent as an architect. I didn't appreciate the details of her pools until I actually swam in them at her pool at Asilomar, for example. There are pools with artichoke tops around the edge of the pool. Once you are in the pool, you realize that the middle ones are markers. Similarly, the ceiling at her pool at Berkeley City Club is beautiful. I didn't fully appreciate the design until I was in it, swimming on my back, realizing that the ceiling design lined up with the tile lane pools, allowing the swimmer to know how to stay in your lane." If you have other favorites about Julia Morgan buildings, do write in and let us know. Let's take some calls. Sylvia joins us first in San Francisco. Sylvia, go ahead, please.
Hi. Okay, so I have an odd favorite building, and that's the Chapel of the Chimes, which is a columbarium that she designed in Piedmont, on Piedmont Avenue. And you know why? It's because of the personal nature of it. Both of my in-laws are there, interred there, and each time I go and visit them, I do get a sense of peace, but also a sense of pride that this building was designed so beautifully for such a function. But then I have something else to say, which is that as a intern freshman in the College of Environmental Design at Berkeley in 1972, what made my career, I think, and the way I view Julia Morgan, is I received a $500 Julia Morgan scholarship. And I have felt an affinity for her ever since.
Great, Sylvia. Thank you. Thanks for phoning that in, that she was a sort of source of inspiration for you back in the 70s and provides that on an ongoing basis today. Thanks. Thanks for the call. Sylvia mentioned Chapel of the Chimes. I know one of your favorites, Julia Donahoe's, is a different church in the East Bay as well.
That's right. In 1906, Julia Morgan was invited to design the interior sanctuary of the First Baptist Church in Oakland at 22nd Street and Telegraph, I believe. And she used that opportunity to design this incredible octagonal truss. And it's the same year as Frank Lloyd Wright was designing the Unity Temple, but this was her own church, and it was her own view of God. And so she had, when she was at Berkeley, studied trusses. She really learned to make trusses well. And there's not a building she's done where she has the same truss design. So in this one, she did this exquisite octagonal truss that's still standing, and you can go see it now. It was in a movie where dreams may come, and it's still in use today. It's just fabulous, fabulous. And it really shows her ideas about engineering and art and design and how she blended that. I think in many ways she was the mother of architectural engineering, because she had the engineering background and she had this incredible Beaux-Arts training. Together, she made some incredible things because of that. And also, you know, just the artistic environment of Paris really influenced her a lot. She was a penultimate architect. She wore the dress. She had the round glasses. She had the black suit and the white shirt. And she loved concrete and steel and glass, but she loved wood as well. And she really made use of it here in Northern California. In almost every building where there's an assembly space, there's a beautiful truss. Sausalito, Mills College, everywhere you go, Asilomar.
Ty Smith was making the point before, and we talked about how her adaptability and that she wasn't wed to necessarily one style and that she was able to work in a variety of ways. But as an architect, Julia Donahoe, is there something distinguishing about her style? Is there such a thing as a Julia Morgan building? Can you walk into a building and know what it is that makes a Julia Morgan building a Julia Morgan building?
I actually have some ability to do that. Can't say for certain, but I have gone, I've been asked to go look at buildings. Is this a Julia Morgan building or not? Or I'm in a building and people say, is this a Julia Morgan building or not? And I'm able to distinguish if the beams are too close. I can feel that. You can walk in her buildings and you can feel that the structure is right. It's designed appropriately for the scale of the space. The rooms are harmoniously proportioned on the classical principles, but they're never actually symmetrical. She uses the Beaux-Arts principles, and then she deviates in a way to make the building breathe and work and flow. She does an exquisite job manipulating her plans and making them beautiful and simple. And she understood energy, and she understood climate, and she understood how to make a building comfortable. She understood all the aspects of making a building that would work and last and adapt to whatever use you might make of it.
We have a question, actually, about whether a particular building is a Julia Morgan building. So we'll put you to the test here. Dana is calling in with that question in San Francisco. Dana, go ahead.
Hello. I'd like to know if the author knows anything about an early Julia Morgan building called Pinehurst Lodge. It's a distinguished building on 30th Avenue in San Francisco, and is very little known. And if she doesn't, where that information could be found?
Okay. Thank you, Dana. Karen or Julia, either of you know that building, Pinehurst Lodge in San Francisco.
I can't think of it offhand. The first place I would go is I would start looking in the newspapers. A lot of newspapers have been digitized, and so early in Julia Morgan's career, you might find some reference to it in digital newspapers. And then more and more materials are being digitized all the time. So I won't go through all the possible materials that you could go through there. I would start there because if it's not easily found in the known collections that have been processed, then I would start with the newspapers and move on from there. See what people are associated with Pinehurst. Do they have another association with Julia Morgan? But offhand, it sounds familiar,
you know,
but I don't.
You
I
know,
don't
there's
know it.
There's a quite a list available, but I don't know if that one's on it. But what I would do is I would take her words that architecture is a visual, not a verbal art, and I would go look at it and see if it has the indicia that indicate that it could be hers, and then I would research further. So I've been asked to look at many houses that didn't have many of the characteristics that we find in her work, and so I'd be happy to go and look at for you and make some suggestions. But so there's both reading the buildings and understanding, you know, is this a Julia Morgan work? Because she said they would speak for her, so it's our opportunity to go and look at them and study them. So
there is a something compiled by Ginger Wadsworth of notable projects that I'm just leafing through here that does not list it, that it isn't
all
inclusive.
That's a very short list.
So, and there is, and I should also point out, by the way, that we have a link on our website to a San Francisco Chronicle slideshow of some of Julia Morgan's best known works. You can go to kqed.org/forum just to see a general slideshow of some of her better known works. There's also a kind of mythology sometimes about some of Julia Morgan's. I was telling the story before our program began about wandering around the UC Berkeley campus the other day because I'd been told that the UC Berkeley Faculty Club, or if not the Faculty Club, the Women's Faculty Club were Julia Morgan buildings, and it turns out neither of them are.
Right.
So sometimes these things build up over time and we think they're Julia Morgan buildings and they aren't. And now let's go to Bob with another phone call. Bob in San Jose. Go ahead, please.
Hi, I just wanted to say I've been to Perth Castle a few times, and I'm amazed every time I go there at the attention to detail and the meticulousness of Julia Morgan's work. To put it in short, her work is just flawless. And to be able to achieve that type of excellence at the time with the technology is just amazing. And it shows in her work. It shows that it's a labor of love.
Bob, thank you. Ty Smith, why don't you pick up on that? Because she did have this, by all reports, an amazing attention to detail, and she would scramble up on the scaffolding and examine things in great detail. She was a small woman. She had trouble with balance later in life. Tell us some stories about her attention to the kind of detail that Bob is referencing in the building of Hearst Castle.
Well, certainly those of us who work there on a daily basis benefit from that. My tenure there is relatively short. I've worked two different times for a total of about 7 or 8 years. But people who've worked there for 30 and 40 years, I'll be walking with them, and they'll notice things that they had never noticed before. So it truly is so detailed. And there is a harmony between the built structure and the grounds continue to evolve. It is just a magnificent place. Julia Morgan, it was one of many commissions. One of the remarkable things is the fact that she rarely stayed on site. She often took the overnight train from the Bay Area into San Luis Obispo and then would work basically the day, usually a Saturday, checking on the progress of certain projects and making new plans for the weeks ahead. But she would be up on scaffolding and sometimes in a little design shack that's out in the back of Hearst Castle still to this day. And going over things, and sometimes when William Randolph Hearst was there, they would be collaborating. And Marion Davies suggested at one point that you could almost see the spark going between their heads as they were sort of going over things, but that kind of transference. But yeah, she'd be up on scaffolding. According to those who were close to her, she lived almost entirely off of coffee and candy bars, and after a day's work would get back in a car and go back to San Luis Obispo and then back to San Francisco. So it really was a labor of love, but it wasn't her only labor. And that's something that should be noted. 30 years of construction, Hearst Castle is still unfinished to this day. We asked one of the sons in the 70s in an oral history interview what it would have looked like if William Randolph Hearst had another 5 or 10 years. And the son said basically one word, and that is different.
Yeah, yeah, ongoing. And yet it was also just her weekend job. Julia Donahoe, you wanted to add?
Yeah, so there is one aspect, and that was Bob, I think. There is one aspect to her excellence and her prolific nature and her attention to detail, which is incredible for architects to look and say, wow, this is amazing. When she was in Paris, she was kind of shunned by some of the students, and she ended up going and sitting and drawing. She went to museums. It was the era of Impressionism. Monet said, sit out in nature and sketch something quickly. So she would sketch the same building from different angles at different times, and she learned to be fast, to create an impression. And so she learned the details from the Beaux-Arts, but she also learned to be really fast. So she was able to go down to Hearst, and she sketched only the amount she needed to sketch to communicate with a craftsman, because she knew what she was doing in terms of all the decorative arts from the Beaux-Arts. But she also learned to be really fast to catch an impression, and then she was able to create it.
Some other comments coming in from our listeners about their favorite building. Michael tweets in the Bayview Hill radio building. Martha, the YMCA on Webster in Oakland. The San Francisco Theological Seminary in San Anselmo. The YWCA, Annalise tweets, in downtown Oakland. And another, the Berkeley City Club, which I know Karen McNeil is a favorite of yours. And another example of attention to detail. I read something where she inspected every tile that was placed or something like that.
Oh, yes. Nothing would be placed without Julia Morgan inspecting it. But, you know, another way that the Berkeley City Club captures that attention to detail is that in any given room of the Berkeley City Club, the windows are different. The style of the windows. And it's another one of those buildings that you can visit dozens of times and still find something new. It's pretty fun.
And originally, of course, the Berkeley Women's City Club.
Yes, so originally, yeah.
Let's go next to Becky in Berkeley, who owns the Julia Morgan House. Becky, go ahead.
Yes, I have a couple of points to make. The first one is that the reason that the person who spoke about having to get recognition from the Architecture Society for Julia Morgan after all those years, the reason that she was able to make that case is that Julia Morgan had pretty much sunk without trace until 1972. Sarah Holmes Boutelle, who was a had actually retired from a career as a teacher, came to California and decided when she saw San Simeon that somebody needed to publicize the fact that this was a woman architect. And she devoted 15 years to doing her seminal biography of Julia Morgan, which finally came out in 1988. But the idea is that everybody needs somebody to recognize their life, especially women do. So unless you acknowledge the contribution of Ms. Boutelle, you're missing a lot of the important parts of the story. That's number one. Number two, I happen to own a Julia Morgan house, just an ordinary family house, not any kind of a grand edifice like the Berkeley City Club. And she did 700 different buildings in her lifetime, including many perfectly normal but well-built family houses. And when we had the earthquake people come and take a look at it to see if it needed to be reinforced, they said they'd never seen a house that was that well-built, and they didn't need to do anything to reinforce it for the earthquake, despite the fact that it's now 100 years old. Wow. So she was not only an aesthetic architect, she was also a very good engineer. And all of her buildings show the engineering training that she has had at the Beaux-Arts. The proportion of the living room of the house I own is beautiful because of the Beaux-Arts training, and the stability of the underpinning of the house, which amazes contractors, is because it was an engineering school.
Great, great story, Becky. Thanks so much. Thanks for adding your story and your experience to our program today. Appreciate it. Thank you. Let's go next to Madison, who toured Hearst Castle and wants to tell us about that experience. Madison, go ahead.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I actually recently finished writing an undergraduate senior thesis about Julia Morgan. And as part of my research, I visited Hearst Castle, not for the first time, but it was the first time I was going there with Julia Morgan at the forefront of my mind. And I attended a tour called Building the Dream, which I just assumed from the name would be a discussion about Morgan and Hearst and the process of actually building the structure. And I was really disappointed by the amount of information given about Morgan. I kept track, and it took about 45 minutes for Morgan's name to even be mentioned. And when it was really just in passing. It was all about Hearst. And some of the information, based on the research I'd done previously, seemed incorrect, like that she was only accepted to UC Berkeley because her brother would escort her around, which, I mean, UC Berkeley has been accepting female students since, I think, 1871. And I have had a lot of experience with people in most of the country not knowing who Morgan was, and it was just really disappointing to me that Hearst Castle was another place where she was sort of being almost underrepresented, because I just assumed if she was celebrated anywhere, that would be the place.
Yeah, Madison, no, thanks for bringing that point forward, and Ty Smith, your response.
Well, just that we have general audiences, and not everybody that comes to Hearst Castle has Julia Morgan at the front of their mind. And so I could see from somebody who was really wanting to delve into that important aspect of the story, if we the guide strayed too far in talking about social history or interior decoration or whatever aspect. The other thing I'll say is that the guides at Hearst Castle don't have a script. And so largely the interpretive experiences there are a meeting. They're really a forum for our diverse visitors to talk about different things, and oftentimes the questions will shape the narrative or the discussion that's going on. So, my apologies to the caller if we didn't hit the right mark for her.
Ty, thank you. Julie Donahoe, it is, I'm sure there's no intent to not pay due attention to Julia Morgan, but it probably does point to the ongoing need there is to put her story forward.
Actually, it's very true. Becky, what you're saying is so important. Your voice speaking up, it's really a big deal. We had to get Maria Shriver and Diane Feinstein and Denise Scott Brown. We had to get other women to fight for Julia Morgan to have this gold medal. There have been 444 gold medals around the world given out in the many, many decades before us. And it's only in the 70s that we had our first woman get a gold medal in England. And there have only been 14 women out of 440. So the ability to even talk about women as architects is still very difficult. Even Julia Morgan wore the uniform and still people couldn't talk about her as an architect. They wanted to make her an interior designer or make her a minimal part of Hearst's equation. But she's so in the forefront there. And when you go in on those tours and they are not talking about her, I think it's a real travesty because they're sowing the seeds that it's done automatically and without really an architect's hand. It was really a strong collaboration between the client and the architect, and we need to acknowledge that. And the tours at Hearst Castle can be improved. I know it's a big part of Asilomar, so I'm sure that they can do better.
We need to wrap up our program. I want to thank all of you for being a part of this, and I want to ask Karen McNeil for just a last maybe one or two recommendations for people who are out and about this week and want to have a little bit of inspiration by seeing a beautiful building. Where would you point them to in the Bay Area this week to go look at a spot that they might not have noticed before?
Oh, my goodness. So one would be the Chinese YWCA in San Francisco. That's a phenomenal Julia Morgan building. And the Julia Morgan Hall up at the Botanical Gardens at UC Berkeley is another spectacular one. The City Club as well. God, there's so many. But those three are great.
And the Bell Tower maybe.
And the Bell Tower. Mills College generally, yeah.
That's still standing ever since 1903.
And the Hearst Memorial Gym is one of my favorites as well.
Thanks all very much. Karen McNeil, Julia Donahoe, Ty Smith at Hearst Castle. Thanks for your participation in our program today. Appreciate all of it. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Thorberg. Our engineer today is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producers are Amanda Supai and Jeremy Siegel. And we get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Brandon Yu and Maxine Schaefer-Wolf. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Joanne Wallace. I'm Dave Iverson. Tomorrow on Forum, we're going to take up the topic of direct democracy. There are 17, count them, 17 ballot initiatives for California voters to contemplate. Is that nirvana, direct democracy, or is it a broken system? We'll take that up tomorrow. This is Forum. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.